Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we're going to talk with the editors of Big Box USA. That's a new book which presents a new look at how the big box retail store has dramatically reshaped the U.S. economy and its ecosystems in the last half century. The rise of big box retail since the 1960s has transformed environments on both local and global scales. Almost everyone has explored the aisles of big box stores. The allure of everyday low prices and brightly colored products of every kind connects shoppers with the global marketplace. This book joins a growing conversation between business and environmental history, addressing the ways American retail institutions have affected physical and cultural ecologies around the world. We want to talk about this with the editors. Bart Elmore is professor of environmental history, core faculty member of the Sustainability Institute at Ohio State University, and author of the award-winning Citizen Coke, as well as Seed Money and Country Capitalism. Professor Elmore, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Rachel Gross is assistant professor of history at University of Colorado, Denver, where she teaches U.S. environmental, business, and public history. She's author of Shopping All the Way to the Woods, How the Outdoor Industry Sold Nature to America. Thank you for joining us.
Glad to be here.
And Sherry Hsu is the Haas Curatorial Fellow at the Science History Institute in Philadelphia and former counselor at large for the American Historical Association. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Maybe just briefly, parenthetically, Sherry Hsu, tell us what Science History Institute of Philadelphia does.
Absolutely. So the Science History Institute is dedicated to telling stories about science and history. So we aim to tell the stories behind the science, and folks are welcome to visit our free museum anytime they are in Philadelphia.
All right, great. Well, appreciate that. Let me start with Bart Elmore. I want to have you give me a little bit of the background, as you guys do in your introduction. Some of the innovations which led up to big box, and we're talking, I guess, you know, Walmart, Target, et cetera, et cetera. We kind of know what big box is. But in the introduction, you took us back to some of the innovations that happened leading up.
Right. You know, I mean, I think we think of the big box store today as just a quintessential fixture of American life, but turns out that it wasn't always that way. And we as historians like to go back and tell those stories. I should mention that we're all close friends and colleagues in a field called environmental history, which I didn't even know existed when I went to grad school. Some of the things you're going to hear today are about our unique approach to this history. Because historians have been talking about, you know, retail and big box stores for a very long time, but maybe not thinking about the ecological roots of these stores, but also the ecological impacts of these stores. But if we go back to the history and some of the smart literature of folks that have written about this, you know, you start to see in the late 19th century and the Gilded Age, these chain stores really emerging. And you can think of companies that like Montgomery Ward and Sears and also trying to figure out how they can get goods to rural markets. But these massive stores, department stores like Macy's and JCPenney, ultimately they're going to merge in the early 20th century, that were figuring out a way to sell goods in volume at low cost. But some big things had to change along the way to get where we are today. One of the big stops was the kind of self-service model. And that actually grew out of Piggly Wiggly, of all things. If you're not from the South, you might not know Piggly Wiggly, but having grown up as I did in Georgia, this was kind of a fixture of the American South. But a grocery store chain that really figured out how to have a kind of self-service model, so you didn't have to have sales staff at every turn kind of helping customers do things. And that the key for big box was always keeping costs down. So that self-service model, I think, which was invented somewhere around 1913 in Piggly Wiggly and then adapted elsewhere, was really critical to getting to where we are today. The other big thing that we saw happening was kind of these large format stores trying to find cheap real estate that you could have these big format kind of setups. It was actually Kroger and an employee at Kroger who began talking about kind of trying to combine this self-service model with a much larger format, kind of big box style kind of format, warehouse almost style structure. Kroger didn't bite at his idea. He had to leave, and he created his own grocery store chain called King Cullen in the 1930s during the Depression. And there you had these kind of two pieces of the puzzle, a kind of self-service model, a large format model where you're maybe finding real estate that's not necessarily in the main center of town, but where you could save some costs on actually the land itself, and then bringing those two things together. But you really don't see big box stores like Walmart, Target, or Kmart until the 1960s. And they all are really introducing, each of these companies, these big box retail stores that are extremely streamlined in terms of their what they look like, and you have these aisles and linoleum, the formats that we're used to today. They all come out at the same time in 1962. The last thing I'll say on this is what made Walmart different than Target and Kmart is that it was focusing on very rural communities. They were going into towns of 5,000 and 4,000 people and proving that you could have this model. Whereas Target and Kmart were focusing coming out of Detroit and Minneapolis on the more urban and suburban markets. So this was a model that spread quickly through Walmart to rural communities, through Kmart and Target to more urban and suburban communities, and really took over the American landscape.
Let me turn to Rachel Gross for the next question. These are, big and box are, two of the big words. And I know that you kind of frame the your discussion of the environment in some of those ways. But I want to concentrate first on big. I wasn't around for the or wasn't conscious of the very first of these huge, stores. As I became conscious of it, my friends, it's new and the hugeness was a big thing. I had a friend who would go to Walmart, and he was going to Walmart. He'd say, "I'm going to go to the People's Republic of Walmart." It's a whole other country, right? There's a Saturday Night Live sketch I remember where they talked about the different climate zones in a Walmart store. So that was, I mean, you had shopping malls, right? But that was individual stores with it, collected within this big space. These were new, and the scale was quite the deal.
The scale is a big part of what we're examining here. And it's not just the store footprints themselves, right? Where we could be talking about a big box store of 90,000 square feet, 150, or even bigger than that. It's also that these warehouse-sized facilities are swallowed up by parking lots that dwarf the size of the building, in part because of their location. So we don't examine this question of the bigness of big box stores by saying, as long as it, meets a certain criteria for this number of square feet, it's worthy of examination, right? Instead, what we're arguing is that kind of looking at the shifting size of these retail facilities over time is important because it shapes the consumer's experiences, right? What you're describing in terms of entering in these cavernous spaces and, feeling something different than it would be like to shop at a different kind of smaller store. And also because the scale suggests a new way that the companies that are running these stores are acquiring goods, right? And they have control over much larger markets and therefore are able to shape what goods end up on the shelf in a different way. So yes, we think of the bigness of these stores as kind of partly the consumer experience and partly what it means in terms of how the kind of the manufacturers, the companies that run the stores are putting products on the shelf.
I want to turn back to Bart Elmore. I'll just quote from the book. Like the main streets and the malls before them, these austere institutions, talking about big boxes, filled with everything from toilet paper to televisions, highlights or at times hide the broader networks in which American shoppers in every town USA are embedded. So, you go to somewhere like Walmart, and as a shopper, you're part of this global supply chain network, and you maybe don't think about that when you're shopping.
You don't think about it at all, and yet that's our whole point. Not only do we not think about it as consumers, but our regulations, environmental regulations, don't see it. These are businesses that are massive. And just to put a fine point on this, Walmart became the largest corporation in the world, not the largest retailer, but the largest corporation in the world. It was bringing in more container traffic than any other firm on the planet into the United States by the end of the 20th century. And as a result, as Rachel was mentioning, you know, it ended up having this outsized influence on shaping the way things were made. It's called the squeeze in the industry. Walmart came up with it, really, which, and I've flown to Bentonville, Arkansas, which is the headquarters of Walmart. And it's a small town in Northwest Arkansas. You would think, oh, shucks, you know, what's going on here? The largest corporation in the world, which, by the way, in the early 2000s, there were, it had the second largest computer system in the world. I think the Pentagon was the only other place that had a more complicated logistics system. And it turns out that these were the companies that really could control things. And if and when you're flying into Bentonville, you can feel the pressure of people on the plane, because they're coming to try and get their product in Walmart. And because of the scale of the bigness of this firm, not just in the United States, Walmart has stores around the globe. You know, getting your product there means you could be, you know, you could make millions. The problem is you're going to have to accept the price that Walmart's going to tell you you're going to have to pay. And so the thing that's so out of sight for us, I think, is that those negotiations, the squeeze that happens in Bentonville, Arkansas, that shapes the price of everything that we consume. And I'll tell you, those rooms, apparently, I've actually walked into the headquarters there, and you can again see people lining up. And I'll also tell you, when you fly out of Bentonville, you can tell the people who've done well. They're very excited, and the bars were, you know, well attended. But, you know, the pressure that goes on in that space to make a fan, for example. Okay, I can make a fan for $10. And Walmart says, that's great. You make it for $6. Come back and we'll talk. And so what that means, though, of course, is labor, environmental effects, right? That means you got to find a place that can do it cheaply, which means cheap labor, which maybe means no unions, which means a bunch of other things. So it turns out when we buy that low, low price in the store, and that's how it's branded, there's a cost that's completely hidden. And so I think this book is trying to show you what the price of that experience is like on a day-to-day basis.
Sherry Hsu, I want to just have you give me, and we'll dive into some of these questions as we go along this hour, but talking about the, you know, the environmental impact of these big box retailers, what are some of the broadly speaking, the questions that that you guys had going in and try to answer in this book?
Absolutely. The sort of the environmental impacts that we're thinking about and the things that are sort of shaping our questioning is that as environmental historians, of course, we're really interested in what the impact of retail is on the environment or environments around us, both the ones that we see and the ones that we don't see. So three of our chapter contributors, Aaron, Laura, and John, their chapters really focus on these areas of the environment that are not really visible when you walk into a Walmart or a Target or a Cabela's. So they're looking at places like swamps and the oceans and distribution centers, all of which are hidden away from consumers and are hidden away from consumers. Other questions that we were wondering about is how do these big retail stores affect how we think about the environment? So my chapter, for instance, is thinking about how do we think of ourselves if we're an angler or a hunter? How do we think through our politics? With Rachel's chapter, we're thinking about how do we interact with the natural world through environments like the retail store, like an REI, and the longer histories of how REI is selling the environment to consumers. So these are all sort of multi-layered questions that we're asking. So we're asking questions not just about sort of the physical impacts of retail stores on the environment, but also about their political impacts and their social impacts. So these are all the ways that we're answering this question. And I also want to make clear that this isn't a book that we set out to be the definitive voice on. What we're really trying to do in this volume is to open it up to other conversations, because we know there's a lot of ways to addressing these issues and a lot of ways that we don't cover in this volume. For example, we aren't talking about the warehouse clubs like Costco or Sam's Club. So these are international places or international chains. And we're also not talking very much about internet retailers such as Amazon, which have also made a huge impact on American society.
Yeah, as you guys point out in the book, Jeff Bezos made a pilgrimage to Walmart, right, when he was setting up Amazon.
That's right. I mean, I actually, you know, we in some ways we do talk about Amazon because by not talking about it, because I think people think of the Amazon economy as a product of kind of sleek Silicon Valley sophistication. And the reality is that, as you'll see in the book, that Jeff Bezos flies in the 1990s to Bentonville, Arkansas. He reads Sam Walton's biography. He's obsessed with the model. He hires his whole team from Walmart. That's a little bit of a stretch, but not really. I mean, Walmart even threatens legal suits for taking their top talent to build out the distribution systems that's going to allow Amazon to do what it does today. And the and I would argue that the truth is for some of these big box stores, by focusing on rural communities, by figuring out how you can get goods to the smallest little towns of 5,000, 2,000 people, which is what Walmart was doing, then you've created these satellite systems and computer networks to be able to do that, that become the envy of the logistics world. I grew up in the American South, and this is not a rah-rah story of, hey, my region created the Amazon economy that we all depend on. It's actually a story of saying, if we don't understand the Southern roots in some ways of how Amazon became what it is, then I don't think we understand these connections to anti-union, you know, labor regimes and the lax environmental regulations that enable all this cheap stuff to be made. And so I think there's a direct connection, as you noted, to Amazon, even though Amazon is not the focus of our discussion in this book.
Well, let's take a break. We'll come back much more with Big Box USA. It's a new book out from University of Wyoming Press, and it's a new look at how big box retail store has dramatically reshaped the U.S. economy and its ecosystems in the last half century. And we're talking with the editors, Bart Elmore, Rachel Gross, and Sherry Hsu. More following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking about a new book. It's called Big Box USA. We're talking with the three editors of the book. This presents a new look at how the big box retail store has not only reshaped the U.S. economy, but its ecosystems in the last half century. Bart Elmore is professor of environmental history, core faculty member of Sustainability Institute at Iowa State University. Rachel Gross, assistant professor of history at University of Colorado Denver. And Sherry Hsu is Haas curatorial fellow at the Science History Institute in Philadelphia. So in this segment, Bart Elmore, let's start with you. You have the first chapter in the book, which is called Welcome Walmart Customers. And here you're looking at how Walmart, the origin story of the America's greatest retail store, and how the ecological roots of the largest corporation on earth shaped this whole topic. One of the things you alluded to this before the break, you say it's important to remember this huge firm became the largest corporation in the world. The rural roots here are important.
Yes, you know, I think it's so critical to me, and I was mentioning before we came on that I come out to Utah every year because I love the outdoors, and I think about the folks living in Utah that probably do the same, you know, get up in the mountains, get out and enjoy those spaces. Walmart's story of why they're even in Bentonville is a product of that. Sam Walton, who founded the company and who I interviewed, I should mention, he died in 1992, but he's been brought back to life as a hologram at the museum in Bentonville. So if you travel, you can actually talk to a AI version of Sam Walton. And if you do that, as I've done, it actually pulls a lot from his autobiography, which I've read. He talks about the environment as being critical to shaping the rise of this huge retailer that shaped, let's be clear, the larger big box ecosystem that we talk about in the book. And you know, his wife too, Helen, was a big outdoors person. Sam was the first, Eagle Scout inside the Boy Scouts out of Missouri. He's one of the youngest Eagle Scouts to attain the Eagle Scout title in Missouri as a young person. And Helen was a big camper. And so when he got into retail, he started at JCPenney. And Helen told him, she said, "We're not moving to a big city. And if you have this vision of going to Chicago or wherever else and doing that, that's great, but I'm not coming with you." And so they ended up in Northwest Arkansas, in part because they loved the outdoors and they wanted to be in a space that was fairly rural. And Northwest Arkansas, for those who haven't been there, is actually one of the mountain biking capitals of the world. It's an incredibly hilly topography and, you know, amazing natural wonders. In fact, I was seeing people flying from states like Utah when I was there because they want to come for the incredible mountain biking in Arkansas, which you might not think about. But they came too, not for mountain biking, but for quail hunting in the case of Sam Walton, and for Helen for camping in the rivers and the streams. But it turned out that trying to build a retail empire in that space led to, as I said, these logistics revolutions, these logistic techniques, I should say, and revolutions that really changed the game, because you had to figure out how to get goods to these small stores in Arkansas and Missouri, often, you know, going through hilly country. And so that required a lot of sophistication that I think led to what was known as RetailLink, this kind of satellite system that enables Walmart to work with its suppliers to be able to put a product on their shelves in a very small town in the middle of the Midwest or the South and get that good all the way from China or suppliers from Bangladesh or somewhere else, you know, almost overnight. And so I think that rurality, as it turns out, that starting in a place, in part because of their own interest in the outdoors and ecology, mattered in terms of the sophistication of Walmart's technologies, technologies that, again, Amazon would later try and build on. So I think we're all, in some ways, a product of personal decisions of people wanting to be in this place, Sam and Helen, that shaped the nature of Walmart's distribution system.
And we'll get into, there's a couple chapters later on in the book, we'll talk about where Walmart and other of these big box retailers are trying to mitigate their ecological effects, and, you know, with some success in some cases. Before we move on to some of the chapters in the book, Bart Elmore, I want to have you talk about just the local impact. These are huge stores with huge parking lots in rural areas. That's for starters, right?
Right. I mean, I actually think that that's the kind of the interesting thing that we saw in this chapter and that John Williams writes about in the chapter on Target is that our laws, the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, were written in the 1970s. This was at a time when, if you looked at the Fortune 500 listings, the most profitable firms were General Motors, were U.S. Steel. I mean, I'm actually laughing as I think about, you know, our economy today and, you know, manufacturing, chemical industries. These were the ones that we were concerned about. And we were looking at those smokestacks. How can we regulate the pollution coming out of those industries? The laws don't do a very good job of looking at the largest corporation in the world, which didn't have the power that it now has as we move from the 80s and 90s onwards to shape, as I said, the entire economy. It mainly looks at things like parking lots. And you're right. When we look at the parking lots, it's a huge effect. Walmart was actually fined the largest, I think, EPA fine in history at the time for violation of the Clean Water Act and stormwater regulations in the early 2000s for just the tremendous amount of ecological degradation caused by these rapid rain events on these parking lots that can then affect creeks and rivers around the environment of these stores. The other thing that you see is roadways, you know, these smaller towns, in order to get the number of people who are going to drive on the highways to get to these stores, you have to build out bridges and roadways and the air pollution that's generated as a result of this. Most people think of Walmart, people resisting Walmarts because they were worried about their hardware store going out of business and local business losing business. And that's one argument. But what we saw in the historical record is that a lot of people were just talking about the environmental effects of what this meant. You know, air pollution from traffic coming into our little town, the stormwater drainage coming off these big parking lots, and the issues there. But I would suggest that we need a revision of our laws. And John Williams does this as well in his chapter. We need a revision that that recognizes the power of retail. Amazon, Walmart, these are now the folks at the top of the economy. And the bigger impact they're having is on this transnational shipment of goods overnight and really quickly. How do we regulate the flow of those goods in a way that, you know, can really affect change in an era of climate change? How can our laws be adjusted to recognize the power of retail today? I think that's the big question for our time.
I want to talk about the next chapter. You made reference to this, Bart Elmore, about target distribution centers. I'll just say before we get to that one, parenthetically, as we're going along talking here, I'm reminded of, this is fairly famous here in Cache Valley, there are beavers in a little stream adjacent to the Walmart in the South Logan or the Providence area. And experts from USU and others have tried to mitigate and help those beavers, and they're living right there in that stream next to the Walmart. So that's kind of a very small ecological mitigation effort there at one of these huge super centers.
But the small matters, because it turns out that one of the biggest ways to fight Walmart was folks finding an endangered species, for example, and saying, okay, well, what are you going to do about this frog that has this particular wetland habitat or whatever it might be that Walmart's going to affect? And so sometimes the Endangered Species Act of 73 became one of the ways that you could push back against these big box stores, finding some kind of species that could be affected in terms of the micro environments of all this. But as you mentioned, John, talking about Target, the distribution centers, you know, if rurality was an asset for a lot of these companies because it meant cheap real estate, it also meant often a cheap labor force, especially in an era of people getting pushed off farms and needing employment in these spaces. That applied to the distribution centers as well that undergird this whole system. It's not just the stores, but these huge, big box format warehouses that John talks about that also created ire. You know, it turns out that rurality was a strength, but it was also a liability. Because people like their rural communities. I can imagine talking to people in Utah, a lot of folks like the big wide open. They like not having, you know, industry right on top of them. And so what we see in this book is also the ways in which people in rural communities fight back. And you see that not only in terms of big box stores being located in small towns, but even distribution centers. People saying, this is going to mar our landscape, this beautiful lake environment, forever. So we try and track both of those stories. It's not just that we need to be concerned about the scale of the stores themselves, but the infrastructure, the distribution centers that are on the periphery of our towns, but that, you know, are in the backyards of people who don't want to see that rural nature of their community changed. And so I think, you know, John's chapter really gets into that really well, looking at Target and their distribution centers.
Before we go to the next chapter, I didn't know this. I learned this from the book. You mentioned King Cullen grocery stores versus supermarkets. So the 20s and 30s, apparently there were chain store wars. There were big debates even back then over whether these huge for their time stores were good for society.
Yes, go ahead, Rachel.
Okay, yeah. The debates about whether they're good for society are reflective of larger concerns about kind of how Americans were shopping and what it said about their identity and their politics. So the chain store wars are not unique in that they reflect kind of the fact that consumers are deeply engaged with these questions of how are we going to access the products that we need? Like when we actually walk into a physical shop, do we talk with a shopkeeper who's going to kind of be the mediator to help us access these products? We grab them off the shelves ourselves. And so I think that's part of the reason looking back at the longer history of retail stores is useful, because it highlights these concerns that kind of consumers, Americans, have thought very deeply about. They don't go shopping casually often, right? They care very much about the process.
Yeah, certainly true. And I well remember, you know, this goes back when the first Walmart was coming into, you know, my hometown, Vernal, Utah, out in the east of Utah. And, you know, debates all across the country. This is going to destroy Main Street, for example, right? So I don't know, that probably parallels some of the debate that was happening in the 20s and 30s. Sherry or Rachel, I wonder if you could tell me about Aaron Van Ness chapter titled Walmart's Ocean. This is an attempt by Walmart, to mitigate the some of the effect of these massive supply chains on the environment.
So Aaron's chapter really deals with how Walmart shapes oceans and ocean economies. That Walmart as a purveyor of seafood, we don't necessarily always think about Walmart as a grocer, but it's one of the largest grocers in the United States. And because of that, they sell a heck of a lot of seafood every year. And one of the things that Walmart becomes very concerned about are these debates over whether or not seafood is sustainable. So what Aaron's chapter does is that it delves into this longer history of how Walmart kind of controls the supply chain of the oceans. And in doing so, because it is such a massive retailer, that it's actually becoming this regulator of what are people able to catch? What are people trawling for? How big is the ecosystem underwater going to be? These voluntary regulations that Walmart adopts and how it guides its suppliers is actually really shaping how the ocean turns out. And in fact, is making a huge impact on the underwater ecosystems, which are absolutely invisible to most of us. So how large a school of a specific species of fish is allowed to grow to, or how many are being taken out of the ocean every year. Those are sort of the things that that particular chapter is talking about, and talking about how ultimately, in a lot of ways, the ocean itself is being shaped by Walmart.
Would you call this a success story, this mitigation efforts? It seems positive on the whole.
Yeah, I think like so many other things, it's a blend of success and maybe some places that could use improvement. So in the particular story that Aaron tells, it's being, these regulations are oftentimes not necessarily are based in fishery science that's not quite up to date, or it's based on sort of what the consumer needs. And there's, it turns out, multiple ways of skirting these regulations that's up and down the supply chain. So it's both sort of a success story in terms of getting people to pay attention to ideas about sustainability and looking for sustainability in the products that they buy. But in practice, there are obviously places that it can be improved.
Yeah. Anybody else wanted to talk about this particular topic?
I'll just add that part of Aaron's point is that it's hard to get a sense, because of the scale, to be critical of kind of what it means for Walmart to only sell sustainable fish, in part because Walmart is the one defining what sustainable fish looks like, right? And so he's basically suggesting that we be critical of this notion of calling it a simple success story, because if the company is in charge of the definition, right, of saying like, well, look, we are only processing this, you know, food stuff in this way, then we are right to be wary of the fact that they are kind of patting themselves on the back for this work and not necessarily thinking as critically about what are the broader impacts kind of worldwide on the world's oceans.
Go next to the next chapter, and then we'll take a break after that. I don't know who wants to talk about Laura Martin's chapter on mitigation banking.
Yeah, I mean, these are all great chapters. Any one of us could probably dive into this. I think one of the things that I hinted at is wetlands. And I think Laura really gets us to think about how big box stores can impact these spaces that we now know from ecology are so essential to the basic functioning of our planet. And nevertheless, seem to be drained, not only to create these big box stores, but, you know, Disneyland and other places, Disney World, I should say, and other places that, you know, when we look back on this 50 years from now, we're going to say, what were we doing? Because we know that these wetlands can, you know, filter out pollution, do all sorts of amazing things. But what we see in this chapter is a really wonderful documentation of how strategies for trying to deal with the ecological harm caused by putting something in a wetland was overcome by developing strategies for saying, well, we'll deal with preserving a wetland somewhere else. And one of the interesting things I found most intriguing by this is how this wetland mitigation strategy, okay, we'll disrupt the wetland here, but we'll preserve the wetland over here as a way of dealing with this, has a lot of problems, as one can imagine, right? No two wetlands are the same. And, you know, there might be an endangered species here that's not over here that's affected by this mitigation strategy. But the larger point being that this is also in some ways akin to and maybe feeds into the way we think about carbon markets and carbon, you know, mitigation strategies. I'm not necessarily going to curb the pollution at my plant, but I'll buy a bunch of trees over here that will capture that. Is this really an effective strategy as we move into this really hypercritical phase of climate change to deal with these big pollution issues, to say we'll cause the harm here, but we'll make up for it over here? So for me, that was a big takeaway from Laura, but others might have found other pieces of it because it was really a brilliant chapter.
One of the points that Laura makes is echoed in our discussion of Aaron's chapter on Walmart's oceans, in that she's pointing out that there are these ghost landscapes, right? This is what we were talking about a bit earlier. Essentially, places in our environment that consumers don't necessarily see, that either through obfuscation or through kind of neglect of the stories, corporations are hiding in some way. And that if we kind of uncover and ask more critical questions of kind of the effects, for instance, of mitigation banking and whether or not it's an effective means to combat kind of climate change and shifts in the environment, we're going to see that these ghost landscapes, though they're not visible, have really deep ripple effects. They have large impacts. And that's one of the big takeaways that Laura has to offer for us.
Let's take another break. We'll come back and talk with Sherry and Rachel about their specific chapters, very interesting chapters in the book. We're talking with the editors today of a new book. It's called Big Box USA. It looks at how the big box retail store has dramatically reshaped the U.S. economy and its ecosystems in the last half century. We're talking with Bart Elmore, Rachel Gross, and Sherry Hsu, the editors. We'll have more following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We've reached our final segment talking about this new book called Big Box USA. It presents a new look at how big box retail stores dramatically reshaped the U.S. economy, but not only that, but its ecosystems. We're talking about business history combined with environmental history. Bart Elmore is professor of environmental history at Ohio State University. Rachel Gross, assistant professor of history at University of Colorado Denver. And Sherry Hsu is with the Science History Institute in Philadelphia. They're editors of this book. I want to turn next to Rachel Gross, talk about your chapter, which is titled Boxing in the Outdoors, Cabela's, REI, and the Growth of Specialty Retailers. And I think we're getting into effects on kind of culture, right? The way we see the outdoors, how we interact with the outdoors. You know, when Cabela's comes, for example, to an area, and it just happened a few years ago here in Utah, that's a huge event. I know I have friends that, you know, traveled 100 miles just to go down and experience the Cabela experience. Tell me about this.
Yes, it is a big event, and that's no accident. One, I should say that, you know, these are really fun stores to go visit, right? And there's a reason that they're drawing shoppers not just from the local area, but from hundreds of miles around. And the reason for that design is the process of Walmartization. In other words, the arguments that other authors in this book make about the shifts in retail in the second half of the 20th century are mirrored in the outdoor industry. And that is despite the fact that many within the industry might actually push back against the association between, say, a Cabela's and REI and Walmart, right? There's a lot of cultural disconnect in the outdoor industry saying we are different from those kinds of stores. We have something different to offer in terms of our products. And certainly in terms of our environment or politics. And what this history of big box stores in the outdoor space reveals is that that difference is not as strong as people within the industry and outdoor enthusiasts themselves might initially imagine. So when I talk about boxing in the outdoors, what I'm suggesting is that outdoor companies have, over the course of the last many decades, brought in so much of the nature experience, the kind of getting out into the woods, excitement of the outdoors, into the retail space. They've created new kinds of retail environments that don't mimic the kind of bright lighting and austere shelves of a Walmart or a Target. Instead, they're doing something quite different. But at the same time, many of the kind of the broader structures of these stores, the large footprints and parking lots, their situation within an urban or rural space, and even kind of the shopping patterns of the consumers all mimic the Walmarts of the world as well. And so the link between these specialty stores and other big box retailers are much closer than people would initially imagine.
Hmm. Anybody else want to comment on Rachel's chapter?
Yes. I mean, I just think it's so important to recognize that this is not just a story about Walmart and Target, and it's about how, and I think you see this at the end, and we'll hear more from Shu about this, that these are spaces that teach us how to be and teach us how to think about nature and our place in nature and whether we have a place. I think we'll hear more about that from Shu in this space, whether we and all of our diversity as a nation are actually reflected in these spaces or not. And, you know, we hoped this would be a book that REI executives would read, that folks inside Big Bass Pro Shop would read, that Walmart would read, because I think we're not out here. There's criticism and all this and analysis as we're required to do, I think, as scholars. But I think there's a lot to learn about, you know, what's not going on in these stores and what visions of conservation are being promoted and what visions are being ignored. So I think this is not just about the impact these stores are having, but also about the culture and how the larger culture that they create has effect. So I think these are really fun chapters and people should stick around for this part of the book.
Well, let's do that. Well, so let's conclude our conversation. We have about 3 minutes left, so let's spend that with Sherry Shu. The title of your chapter, Bass Pro Shop, Selling Conservative Conservation. Tell me about this briefly.
Yeah, so the main argument in this particular chapter is that I'm really looking at Bass Pro Shops and the ideas that it's selling within its stores. I think we can... when we think about a Bass Pro Shop or a Cabela's and we think about the kind of people who shop there, we tend to think of them as maybe politically more conservative than people who might shop at REI or the North Face or Patagonia. But I think in a lot of ways that this sort of division is artificial, because you'll never meet a hunter who hasn't hiked out to their hunting site or an angler who hasn't hiked out to their fishing spot. But in this particular case, what I'm interested in is why does Bass Pro Shops position itself as the world's leading conservationist firm? Why is it that they are very much into this identity of conservation, and how do they sell that? And the ways that they do so is that they have museum spaces that position hunters and anglers as real stewards of the environment, that you can go to their museums, and they have these all around the country, and sometimes they're inside of actual Bass Pro Shops. So if you go to the Memphis Pyramid, which is the world's 10th largest pyramid by some account, and it's a Bass Pro Shop, when you go inside, you can walk through the aisles of the store, and a lot of the products that are being sold are talking about how safe they are for the environment. And then you get up to the upper stories, and you can walk through a museum space that tells you about how hunters and anglers have really been at the forefront of conservation, and how hunters and anglers are true stewards of the environment, because they are the people who are out in the outdoors, and they are the ones that are trying to preserve this space for future generations. And I think they are drawing a distinction between an environmentalist and a conservationist in that sense.
Well, much more we could say about this. We'll have to leave it there. We're out of time. Interesting book. You can pick it up now. Big Box USA, The Environmental Impact of America's Biggest Retail Stores. And we've been talking with the editors of the book, Bart Elmore, Rachel Gross, and Sherry Hsu. Thanks to each of you for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And thanks, everyone, for listening to Access Utah. We'll go out, as we do on Thursdays, with Leo T. and Skywatcher.
It's one sky, many cultures. Skywatcher Leo T. Wow, there are so many huge happenings in the sky right now, creating a very exciting and intense look into celestial events coming right to us. There's a geomagnetic storm from our home star. It started on March 24th, continues on, sparked by recent solar eruptions that have hurled plasma toward Earth. This comes from the Space Weather Prediction Center. It's a division of NOAA. This powerful solar storm can cause power grid fluctuations, disruptions in the power supply, as well as affecting space operations and ships at sea and all sorts of things. The most visually stunning effect of this geomagnetic activity is the potential visibility of the aurora, or northern lights, at high latitudes in the United States. Regions such as northern Michigan and Maine could witness this breathtaking natural phenomenon. And speaking of solar activity, if you're in the path of totality for the April 8th total solar eclipse, you'll experience a breathtaking, surreal period of darkness. Totality for a few seconds or minutes. This is the only safe time to look directly at the sun without solar eclipse glasses, but I wouldn't risk it unless you're practiced at doing this. If you observe the sun's corona during totality, you may see dark pink towers and loops of electrically charged plasma stretching many times the diameter of Earth into space and right on what looks like the sun. These prominences will almost certainly be on show during the totality of the North American eclipse on April 8th. Lots of reminders that we are in space here on our humble planet Earth as we look around and up. The green comet Pons Brooks is nearing its best showing in the early evening. As Mercury fades into the sunset, Jupiter becomes the only easy planet in the entire sky in the west northwest, and big old Jupiter will help us find the comet. Comet Pons Brooks is fairly low in the west northwest right after the end of twilight. It is lower right of Jupiter and heading toward it. Its tail points upward right now. Next week it should be at its best. On the evening of March 30th, the comet will be passing right next to, or to the lower right, a fairly bright Alpha Arietis, or Hamal. The 10-mile-wide green comet has been bright, putting it well in range of binoculars in a decent suburban sky, and it may be detectable naked eye in a black sky. Brightness outbursts are possible. The comet has had two in the last year, so check in on it every clear evening. And continuing with amazing once-in-a-lifetime simultaneous events in space invisible from our planet, a cosmic explosion will be visited to the naked eye. This is going to happen. A rare cosmic eruption expected to occur in the Milky Way is coming in the coming months, an outburst so bright that a new star will seemingly appear for a short time in the night sky. The event, known as a nova, will be a once-in-a-lifetime sky-watching opportunity for those in the Northern Hemisphere, according to NASA, because the types of star systems in which such explosions occur are not common in our galaxy. The stellar eruption will take place in a system called T. Corona Borealis, which is 3,000 light-years away from Earth. It contains two stars, a dead star, also known as a white dwarf, closely orbited by a red giant. Red giants are dying stars that are running out of hydrogen fuel in their cores. In systems like T. Corona Borealis, the two stars are so near to each other that matter from the red giant is constantly spilling onto the surface of the white dwarf. Over time, this builds up pressure and heat, eventually triggering an eruption. At its peak, the eruption should be visible to the naked eye. It's going to be bright in the sky, so it should be easily visible from your backyard. Astronomers predict that the nova explosion could happen any time between now and September. Once an eruption is detected, the best and brightest views will likely come within 24 hours when it reaches roughly the same brightness as the North Star. The outburst may remain visible to the naked eye for a couple of days before it begins to fade. Even after it dims, though, sky watchers will likely still be able to spot the eruption for around a week using binoculars, according to NASA. T. Corona Borealis system is normally too dim to see unaided, but sky watchers can find the outburst by locating the constellation Corona Borealis, or the Northern Crown, or the Council of the Chiefs, as natives call it. Constellation is a semicircular arc above the Big Dipper, and this is just above it, T. Corona Borealis. A supernova in 1054 was seen around the world and recorded in China as well as in the desert southwest, U.S., and etched into sandstone cliffs. For the Hopi and other peoples in northern Arizona, it was a wild year with the eruption in the sky and an eruption near their home in northern Arizona that set out lava around the area, and the Hopi and Navajo were wondering if they were doing something wrong in their ceremonies. Visit Wupakki National Monument near Sunset Crater and see the Sunset Crater Volcano Dome that happened in 1054. Lava flows here as well as fantastic ancient dwellings. As we look up, look around, and get just a little bit lost in space, as well as exploring our precious blue marbles treasures. Skywatcher Leo T.